Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or you can go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about emerging technologies and emerging possibilities. We talk about what's happening in the world today and where we think the world is going, and we're not afraid to take a pretty unusual view of that. We believe that if you're not excited about the future, you're not paying attention. We believe that there's a pretty good case to be made that the world might just be getting better all the time. And we believe that something is going to happen, something wonderful. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you, man?
I am super fantastic. Back from Vegas, tanned, rested, and ready. How about you? How you doing?
Oh, excellent. Excellent. Got Michael with us tonight.
Evening, Michael is holding down the chat room. How are you, Michael?
I'm good. It's springtime in the Rocky Mountains, inexplicably.
Beautiful day today. I got tulips coming up in my flower bed in the front yard. I can't remember that happening this early ever before. So I think we're in for an early summer. Here's hoping, anyway. And yeah, life is good. So
I know we got this huge show ahead of us, Phil, but I need to ask you. A couple of weeks ago, you mentioned that you were going to get the opportunity to see some new 3D display technology. And while in Vegas, and now you're back, so I need to ask you, what is that all about, and is it cool, or what are we talking about? And we may have lost Phil. Phil, you may have muted yourself. Yeah, I hear you now. Okay, I'm not hearing you, Phil. All right.
How about now?
I hear you now. Great.
Okay, I will not touch that button again. It's dangerous. Here's the thing about this. Let me tell you what's going on with this headset, okay? The same button that controls volume is what mutes you. It mutes your microphone. So if you touch it in just exactly the wrong place, you're off the air. So it's a great little cough button feature if you want to use it as a cough button feature. But if you're trying to control your headset volume, suddenly you mute yourself. So thanks for keeping me honest on not being able to hear me.
Okay. Yeah. That'd be kind of rough. You explain the whole thing, and I say, oh, by the way, I didn't hear you.
By the way, we've had 30 seconds of dead silence, so you could hum the Jeopardy tune or something, right?
Tell us about the 3D tech.
Yeah, so I was in Las Vegas last week. We were doing a big product launch. And we had a hospitality suite. We had a big party to celebrate the launch of the product. And one of my events people, person who runs events for Sybase, was in touch with these folks in Las Vegas who had a unique display technology to offer. We were talking about doing flash demos and PowerPoints and, you know, things we'd like to show on screen. I was actually talking about having a big projector and projecting these images while the band plays and all this kind of stuff. And she says, well, I think we've got something even more exciting than that. These guys have 3D monitors. And I'm like, what does that mean, 3D monitors? And she said, well, it projects a 3D image and you don't need glasses. And I didn't believe it. I mean, I kind of believed it, but until you see it, it's just absolutely astounding. We had these big displays and we had all our messaging about the new product, the new product that we were launching, and these animations in 3D. Now, what I assume is happening here is that somehow this monitor, because it's a special computer technology they're using and a special monitor, that somehow it is providing the stereoscopic mixing of images that you would normally get from the glasses, because you had to. if you look straight at it, or even from any of a number of different angles, you got the 3D image. But if you were just in between one of those spots, you'd see two images, right? So it's not absolutely perfect. You did have to look at it just right. But man, when you look at it just right, it was like these images extending out of the screen into the space between you and the screen. It was just absolutely unbelievable. One of the coolest things I've seen in a long time, and I think it says that we'll have 3D TV here in a few years.
Oh, that is cool.
We're looking at the first early vestiges of 3D TV. I mean, it'll probably take us a while to get to it because they've still got kinks to work out in the display technology, but also because I guess there's just such an adoption thing going on right now with high-definition TV and with Blu-ray and all that kind of stuff. But watch for once everybody's up to speed on that, early adopters, are going to start having 3D TV. So that's a fun one to look forward to.
I wonder if the technology to be able for the TV to be able to know where you are in the room, to be able to recognize faces, and then adjust to each person that's in the room, so that each person could have their own, you know, their own individual 3D. I wonder if that would, you know, just throwing that out there as a possibility, so that you wouldn't have to be like dead in the good zone or the sweet spot.
That's a really interesting idea, and I think that that's one possible way they might get there, because we know we have this face recognition technology with cameras.
That's right.
No reason why a TV couldn't do that and say there's a face there, there's a face there, there's a face there, so 3D images are going out on trajectories to those faces. You would wonder, you know, up to how many people would that work, right? Yeah, could you have 27 people watching the TV and it's going to send a perfect 3D image to each of them? But it's a cool idea. I like the way you're thinking with that. But let's move on past 3D display technology, because as you mentioned, we have a ton of great stuff we want to get into. For those who've read our description on the blog, we're going to be talking about breakthrough ideas for 2009. And our touch point for this is a list of 20 breakthrough ideas that were published in the Harvard Business Review. And what I thought we would do is we'll just spend some time on these. We'll deal with 10 of them tonight. Maybe we'll deal with them 10 of them next week. And if we still like the topic, maybe the following week we'll start coming up with some of our own breakthrough ideas. But I like the idea of breakthrough ideas. I like the idea of let's talk about positive things that can happen, or game-changing concepts that we probably need to be aware of, that we probably need to contend with in the year that we're heading into here.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I'm just going to jump right into the list. We'll provide a link in the show notes to the Harvard Business Review article with this list of 20, but I think we'll just work through them in order, if that's okay.
Cool.
And I'll start with the first one, and this was entitled, "Just Because I'm Nice, Don't Think I'm Dumb," and it was written by Amy J.C. Cuddy. And she talks about how researchers have developed this scale of warmth and competence. Okay, so these are like two qualities of a person in a business setting that you would measure. And people have different feelings or different tendencies towards others, depending on whether they think they're dealing with somebody who's got a lot of warmth, or whether they think they're dealing with somebody who has a lot of competence. We want to reach out to people who are warm. If we think that somebody has warmth, then that's somebody that we want in our lives, generally. And we want to interact in a business setting with people who are competent. And one of the interesting things I noted there was that the model explains why elderly people get disrespected.
Yeah.
Even though we like them, right? We like the elderly, it says, but the problem is we think they're warm but incompetent. That's the stereotype, unfortunately, that the elderly, the niche that they get moved into. And so the respect isn't there, even though good feelings maybe are pointed in their direction. And I will note in passing that I overheard some people at the gym today talking disparagingly about the over 40 crowd. And,
okay. Over 40? Already incompetent in the minds of some people? Is that,
they were just so horrified by their, you know, receding hairlines and sagging waistlines, and I was just like, wow, I've got to get away from this conversation right now. But then I read this, and I said, oh, okay, they still like me. They just don't think I'm competent. So that made me feel so much better. Here's what's interesting about this dichotomy is they're not mutually exclusive, but an excess of one is taken to be a lack of the other.
Right.
So in particular in a business setting, if somebody is seen to be very warm, then that is that's counted off their competence. There's no way it's the old nice guys finish last, right? There's no way they're going to be perceived as somebody who can really get things done if they've got this whole, you know, they're a little too nice problem. And what Cuddy talks about here is that we have to separate these two dimensions to deal with people more effectively. And
yeah.
What this reminded me of, to use one of PJ's favorite terms, was this need for empathy. And because as I was reading this, I was thinking, you know, I have seen over the years, particularly in previous jobs, I won't talk so much about the one I currently have, but in previous jobs, I've seen problems where the lack of competence actually was a lack of warmth. You know, if you're talking about a person who has to deal with other people and they're not able to do it because they lack that ability to, as PJ would say, or, you know, as any of us would say, if we're using the term, empathize with others. And to me, this speaks for the need for a more human kind of a workplace. I don't know. What did you think about this one?
Well, one thing I thought what brought this home to me was the fact I read this and I thought to myself, you know, this sort of explains my work personality versus my off work personality. And I'm sure everybody that's a professional or, you know, has a job in the workplace knows what I'm talking about. At work, you know, your first day on the job, you might try to be the cool new guy at work or whatever and try to do things exactly like you do away from the office setting. But you quickly learn that's not the best way to go for things to go smoothly. And so you end up adopting maybe a slightly less, funny or a slightly more serious personality. And, dialing the warmth back is basically what it amounts to in order to be taken seriously on the job. And then, you know, you clock out and you hit the car and then, you're taking a call from a friend. Hey, dog, the warmth can come out once you leave the office. It's
you
sort
get
of
to be nice
thing.
Again. Yeah.
Yeah. It's sort of a funny thing. I don't think it's just attorneys. I think it's everybody that, you just allow yourself to be a little more warm. And it's sort of funny. I mean, I guess you have to judge every situation as to what the expectations are of the people within the circumstance. How warm should you be, or how confident should you try to come across? It's good when you can combine them both, but sometimes it just doesn't work out that way.
Well, what's interesting about that is, you can definitely see the whole "I've got to tone the warmth thing down, got to turn it back up." But you never shut down. It's like you get off work, now I'm going to be nice again, but you never shut down the competence, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
Or do you? Or do you? I don't know. Maybe you get home and it's like, I can't deal with any of this stuff.
To some extent, I suppose it depends on how tired you are at the end of the day. But I mean, you don't turn up the stupidity. You just turn up the warmth, you know. And the thing is, I have met plenty of incompetent jerks and very warm, very competent people. You know, it's like you say, the point is obviously try to do better at separating the two. And so I don't know quite how you would do that.
Should we get an expert
system to help us out, or I don't know.
Yeah. Well, we'll probably need that eventually. But I think that it comes to recognizing that not only are they not alternatives, but that there is a point where they meet, where some level of you hear about this idea of like EQ, emotional IQ. There's some point where your competency in the workplace is going to be measured by how well you can empathize with and interact with other people. So I think if we could start by seeing.
Okay.
Am I
lost you
here?
Just for a second. We lost you just for a second. You're back.
It told me I was in the host queue.
That's strange.
Just as I was driving it home. What I was saying was that if we started with where those two things meet, I think we could understand a lot more about how the two need to work together. That would be my take.
Good take. good place to finish that one off on.
All right. Well, this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're working through a list of 20 breakthrough business ideas. And if you'd like to, if you're listening live, if you'd like to join our conversation, we've got a live chat in the chat room, or leave your comments at blog.speculus.com. All right, Stephen, how do you want to do this? You want to swap off between them, or do you want to?
Sure, sure. The next one on the list is Beware Global Cooling. And this is an article by Peter Schwartz, and he's basically saying that, yeah, we've got global cooling, and we've had this for the last 2 or 3 years, but it's just a lesser trend within a greater trend of global warming. And so don't let this catch you off guard. We really have global warming, and it's still the real deal. We may take a couple of years off from global warming, but we still have it. My thought on this is there's a related story within this group that we're talking about putting out global sensors basically a network of sensors so we can understand the world climate better. I think it would help if we had a greater understanding so that we could say more definitively, here's what's going on, and base our policy decisions on better information. I think better info is always good.
I would agree completely. I think it's real interesting that if you read the whole article, Peter Schwartz, who of course is one of the co-founders of the Global Business Network and kind of the genius behind the scenario planning methodology that they employ, that he was involved in global cooling research back in the 70s. So here's one of these guys who actually made that transition from global cooling to global warming. So one of the things I would have expected to see in there that I did not see would have been, yeah, let's beware global cooling, because that's also just another possibility. And if you're a scenario-based planner, you want to look at not just one thing that's definitely going to happen, but this one might happen or this one might happen. So we need to beware global cooling as a possibility that might mislead us away from global warming, but also as, wow, that would be a devastatingly bad thing if that's actually what's occurring. And then also you would think the third scenario would be stasis, that actually we're seeing something like normal fluctuations and things don't change all that much. So to me it felt like Schwartz was abandoning his methodology there just a little bit, and I would like to have seen it presented more the way he normally does.
Yeah. Again, more info.
More info, yeah. I'd like
before
more
we commit ourselves completely to one group of policies, I think we just need a little more information. So anyway, that's just me.
Yeah. And more scenarios would be great. Okay, the third one was called Institutional Memory Goes Digital. And this was Gurdeep Singh Paul and Rita Gunther McGrath. And this is a intriguing, if not terrifying, scenario that they've laid out for us here, talking about technology that can record every word spoken, every facial expression at every meeting, saved by your workplace in perpetuity. And the technology is with us or will be with us very soon, and this would be then available to a fixed responsibility for decisions. There'd be no question about how a certain decision was arrived at, because you could always go back and check the tapes, as it were, or the digital recording. Could be used to defend a business decision in court. Of course, those meetings could also be discovered and used to get a company in a lot of trouble. And they talk about this next step, which would be recording technology that captures facial expressions, so that we would not only be recording what individuals said, but whether how they looked at the time is in line with how they normally looked when they were talking about these kinds of things. So it starts to sound like not only is every word going to be recorded, every facial expression going to be recorded, but we're going to be hooked to kind of a lie detector all the time.
Well, so if you're rolling your eyes while you're saying something that would come across on a recorder as if you were serious, it gives the impression that you meant the exact opposite.
Yeah, I think that this technology is very likely. I think that we will see it. I don't think we're going to see it in 2009 many places, but I think we will see it. I don't know about the lie detector piece so much. That probably comes later. But the idea of recording all meetings, I've seen in the workplace where meetings have gone from telephone conferencing now to video conferencing, and I forget how much easier, how much more difficult would it be? Yes, you need the server space, but just to record all those meetings.
Yeah.
But what's missing there is that's only formal meetings, you know. And you got to think about the informal stuff that occurs. You meet somebody
at the
coffee machine. Yeah, exactly. Or you just step into somebody's office. You're not quote unquote having a meeting. You just stop by. Hey, how's it going? First thing you know, you're talking about something. First thing you know, you've decided something. Well, that was a meeting. So I think in order for this to be effective, you would have to have the company recording every employee every minute of every day. Okay, so now we've got to have something similar to your face recognition technology built into the walls, right? Because it's going to be tracking you in every room you go in the company and constantly recording everything you do. Now that I think is a little further out, but I would not be at all surprised to see that implemented. What are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, you would have to be constantly on guard. Any stray, you know, glance at the member of an opposite sex, any stray remarks, it could end up, this sort of thing could almost end up stifling creativity too, because, you know, you're afraid to say anything wild or outlandish at all for fear that, you know, that could be used against you at some point. You know, sometimes you need to be free to, you know, say something crazy just to get the ball rolling on good ideas. So I don't know if I think it could cut both ways.
Yeah. Well, let me just throw one little scenario out there, and this is the tip of the iceberg, okay? But you know how this happens sometimes. Sometimes you reach that point where blowing your nose isn't enough. Okay, you know what I'm talking about. Now, right?
Yeah, and then you're on camera, and of course, then the office jokester puts it on the overhead or something. Yeah.
Yeah, you got the hanky in there. You're working it, you know. And
yeah.
And that's the tip of the iceberg. I think it's not just creativity. It's like all of life could be potentially stifled. Either that or people just lose all inhibitions.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the two things would have to happen. You just have to be like, oh, okay, you can see me do anything. I don't care. Here goes. Here, it's all out there for you. But
yeah.
But I think that would work better for new people coming into the workplace with that understanding, rather than people who've worked for a long time with it, such that you could close your door and no one's listening to you. Right. That's going to be a hard one to a hard chasm to cross, I would say.
Absolutely.
Okay, what's next?
The next one is Stumbling to a Longer Life, and it's Lou McCrary who wrote this article, and this one's pretty bizarre, I have to say. A couple of architects, Arakawa and Madeline Gines, declared that they have no intention of dying, and so they're designing urban living spaces intended to help extend human lifespan. Uneven floors, uneven colors, difficult to navigate stairs and walkways. Now, the idea, of course, is to, you know, continue to keep you sharp by making you have to, you know, navigate these crazy rooms. But, you know, it's also a good way to fall and break a hip. So I don't see, difficult to climb stairs being necessarily something that would help me live longer. You know, give me a normal house.
As our show's official personal injury attorney, I'm glad we have you here to vet these ideas about the future.
Yeah, this idea stinks from beginning to end. I think I'll stick with standard stairs and flat floors. If I need to work on my, you know, coordination or something, I'll go, I don't know, play tennis or something, but I don't need this.
Go work out, huh?
Yeah, well, go work out.
Yeah, I can see your resistance. For one thing, if you look at the picture, the place looks just plain weird. I mean, the picture that's posted there.
It looks like Salvador Dali as architect is what it looks like. You know, it's like the room is melted in some bizarre and weird ways. It's you know, gross. I have no desire to live or even.
Well, I'll say this. I like the way they think. Okay, I like that Arakawa and his wife Madeline Gines, however it's pronounced, that they state that they have no intention of dying.
Oh, yeah, that's, I'm with them on that.
And it's very interesting that they have sought a remedy to that through their own profession of architecture. I would not have looked for life extension through architecture. So that's kind of intriguing, too. Now, it's the implementation, right? I'm with you on that. I look at that and I go, well, I would not want to live there. And I don't believe that seeing weird colors and having to dodge big hunks of concrete is going to build my immune system. I think it probably would help me to stay more mentally alert until I smashed my face at some point.
Until you're lying on the floor, knocked out, in which case you're not very alert then. Oh, well.
But let me ask you a question. Let me throw this out though. What if it worked? What if living in a weird, uncomfortable house actually could add 15 years to your life? And I'm talking 15 solid, good, mentally competent years to your life. Would you live in
Here's the thing. You said solid and good. I'm not sure living in a house like that would be solid and good, even if you had 15 more years. I don't know. I just had a very visceral reaction to that architecture. I'm sorry.
A fair response. I mean, that's kind of the whole, calorie restriction kind of argument, right? Well, it's like if you just can't live, if you don't feel like you're living, the fact that it's extending your life doesn't really help all that much, right? I mean, it's too hard. If it would be too hard to live in a place like that, would it really matter? I think that if I was healthy, if I knew for a fact that it was the difference between, say, 85 and 100, and those last 15 years were actually good, healthy years, and somebody gave me a guaranteed no hip broken on the concrete thing, I might go for it under those terms, but who could actually offer such a guarantee? That's the problem with that one.
I guess so.
Okay, let's move on to the next, because this is actually kind of connected in a way. The next one's called Launching a Better Brain, and this was by Steve Jurvetson. He is a venture capitalist, the guy behind Hotmail, Steve Jurvetson. Now he talks about how schools and workplaces tend to reinforce these kind of very tight, very small areas of domain expertise. So like, Stephen, you're a lawyer and you specialize in a particular kind of law, and probably even within the practice that you're in, you probably specialize within a certain number of cases there. In my job, I do marketing for a particular kind of product and then for a particular product, and then we talk about particular market segments within that. It gets very focused and very very narrow. And to be successful, you have to do that. It's like you have to spend most of your life focused on this kind of thinking about the same things, kind of the same ways most of the time. And so to combat this, Jurvetson now goes out and shoots off model rockets with his son, and he says this is actually good for his brain. Because he's taken on a completely new field of endeavor, and he's encouraging the term that's used is neuroplasticity. The old idea was that once you reached a certain age, your brain stopped growing, you couldn't get any more neurons, you were done. And we've learned in the last few years that that's not true. We can grow new neurons, we can make new connections, and our brains are very much more flexible and plastic than we thought they were. But one of the things that has to happen, and this is what Jurvetson's talking about here, as we age, we have to find new things to think about. We have to get out of the ruts that the workplace or that school or, our social lives, whatever, have put us in, because they're going to have us thinking the same kinds of things all the time. We have to break out of that. We have to be creative, and we have to find new things to focus on in order to keep our brains growing. Now, one of the things Jurvetson says here is cognitive exercise will keep you agile, adaptive, and fit for life in business and on. So I look at this one, and then I look back at the previous one, and I say, oh, okay, well, maybe I don't have to live in a weird house. Maybe I can live in an okay, normal house and, go outside and collect butterflies or something, do something really different, and it would have the same life-extending kinds of benefits.
I saw something recently. I think it was on the Discover Channel or something like that. They did a test where they showed babies, newborn babies, pictures of different people, and then different animals. Maybe like a might show them 10 different pictures of 10 different people and pictures of 10 different animals, And then they would show the same thing to like a 3-year-old or a 6-year-old and stuff like that. And they found that newborn babies spend the same amount of time looking at individual human faces as they do individual lemur faces or something like that. And it's like their ability to differentiate between faces is greater at a younger age. But as we get older, those areas of our brain are sort of pruned out so that we maintain the ability to differentiate human faces. But when we see a lemur, it's just a lemur. You know, we lose that ability to differentiate between different lemur faces or whatever. Because
interesting.
And so anyway, I guess the whole point is, you know, to maintain some of this plasticity as we get older is a good thing. It allows us to be more creative. And so, yeah, I agree completely. I just don't think a weird house is necessarily the way I'm going to do it.
Well, I think you've made that quite clear, Steve. I don't think any mistaking where you are on the weird house. But actually, Michael was asking in the chat room, are you saying all lemurs look alike? Well, that's the thing. If you want your brain to continue to grow and that's your area of interest, go study lemurs, right? Become one of these people who, even at an advanced age, can distinguish between lemurs, and you'll be doing your brain a tremendous service, according to what Jervison's talking about. Okay, well, this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're working through, at a breakneck pace, a list of breakthrough ideas from the Harvard Business Journal, and Stephen's about to take us to the next one.
The Rise of Forensic Economics, and I thought this was fascinating. It was Raymond Feisman, I guess is the way he pronounced his last name. Fraud detection on a massive scale, looking for the economic fingerprints of corruption. In other words, if you know, you see a situation where you know, they shut down a certain corruption in a certain area, and then the stock drops in the United States in a particular company, you know, that maybe should not have been exporting arms or something like that to a country, then you know that maybe that's a sign that maybe they were involved in corruption there. And so this is an example of, you know, using objective measures. It's like a new science they're coming up with, using objective measures to determine if or track down at least opportunities for being corrupt, if not corruption itself. And I think it's a fantastic idea. I don't know that I necessarily gave the best example of that, but it's very, very interesting. I think there's an opportunity here to lessen corruption and the opportunity for corruption.
Yeah, well, the examples that Feisman, whatever his name is, gave were, one was this trying to identify who was selling arms into Angola. And when the ceasefire was called in Angola, you looked at whose stock prices went down. That was interesting to me, because I was like, okay, well, if their stock prices went down, that meant that the investors knew they were selling arms into Angola, right? I mean, somebody knew that. It wasn't as
sort of an open secret, apparently.
Yeah, at least amongst the investors. But the other example I thought was real interesting was prior to the return of Hong Kong to the People's Republic of China, comparing these trade manifests, this goods that were being exported to China, and the Chinese documents that recorded goods that were being imported, and all the items with the high tariffs were getting lost somehow in the transition from Hong Kong to China. So in examining that way after the fact, he was able to detect that corruption was occurring. And his point is, if you don't just let me do this historically, if you don't just tell, if you tell economists rather than you study this and find fraud in history, you can study the current data, you can find out what's happening now. It's a lot like the kinds of systems that credit card companies put in place, right? They have massive fraud detection algorithms that they use to track individual consumer behavior. Well, yeah, why not do the same thing? Why not track what governments are doing, track the money that's changing hands between government contractors and government entities and NGOs, with the same kind of algorithms in place, looking for things that raise red flags, looking for things that raise eyebrows. I think it's a good idea too. And in fact, if you want to swing this one back around to one of the earlier ideas, why don't we get this 24/7 surveillance that we're all going to be subjected to in the workplace for government officials? Don't you think that would be a good idea? Right? Think about the fraud detection on a credit card, right? What if...
Edwards and Bernstein and what's the other one? Anyway, you can imagine the future, these future reporters going out, Woodward and Bernstein, excuse me.
Woodward and Bernstein, that's right.
Yeah, using these tactics to follow the money, you know, in politics or wherever, to determine, you know, where the corruption is and to unravel some of these mysteries. I think it's a fantastic idea. The two examples he gave I'm not so crazy about, because he's giving examples of ways that governments can crack down on free markets, which I don't think is necessarily a great idea, but I think keeping track of our government officials is a wonderful idea, and being able to follow the money using these techniques is great. So, anyway.
Yeah, I like the idea. I like the idea of, especially if we're all going to be subjected to surveillance technology anyway, put the whole public sector under the same kind of scrutiny. And then if, you know, a bunch of senators go out, they have a great time. If they spend all the money, then we know that they wasted taxpayers' money. If they didn't spend all the money, then we know who spent the money, and we say, hey, undue influence, right? It would be nice if all these controls are going to be put in place anyway,
right,
to have them firmly in place in the public sector. I think that a tremendous amount of good for just restoring confidence in the system. All right. Well, the next item on the list is called the IKEA factor. This is an interesting one. This was Stephen. You're familiar with IKEA?
Yeah.
It's very exciting because we're getting one put in my neighborhood here in the next few months, or at least they were it was before the economy crashed. I hope we're still getting it. But IKEA is this Scandinavian household goods supplier that sells a lot of furniture. I'm actually sitting at an IKEA desk right now, and I'm looking over at a CD rack that's IKEA. And the genius of IKEA is you buy stuff and it's all in a big box, and then you take it home and you assemble it yourself. You put this stuff together yourself. And that's how this phenomenon that's being discussed in this item got its name, because once you've put some labor into something, you develop maybe an undue fondness for it. And labor enhances the affection that we have for the results of that labor. So if we work on something, we're going to value it disproportionately to how much we would value it if someone else had put the work into it. Like this desk, I'm pretty darn fond of this desk, but I assembled it. If somebody else had, maybe I wouldn't have such a fond feeling for it. And this is huge because this starts to explain why in a corporate setting, managers will keep pumping resources into projects based partly on the amount of work that's already been done rather than what they expect to get back from it. Right, it's like they look and they say, "Oh, we've put all this work in. Got to keep going."
Right.
Can't
turn back now.
Yeah, it's the sunk cost effect.
Yeah.
And this is how you end up throwing good money after bad. And it also accounts for the not invented here syndrome, where an organization will value a solution that they came up with in house over something that was brought in by, you know, a quote unquote outsider. And this is something I worked in telecom for years and years. Particularly on the IT side, it was a big problem we had in the telecom world, which was that you had the idea for office productivity, just about any kind of software you would buy. Of course, you would find a vendor and you would purchase software. But for the billing system, for the rating, for anything that touched the phone network, there was this thinking on the part of the engineers who worked in IT at the phone company. Well, obviously, we do that. You know, we've been working on these systems for years, and we're not going to go out to some vendor and buy that from somebody. And in some ways, the American telecom infrastructure fell behind Europe and Asia in some ways because we were so reluctant to take on technologies that weren't invented here. It happened in the back office systems, and it also happened in things like digital mobile, which we adopted much slower than other countries did. So this getting overly attached to the items that we've worked on. What do you think of that? What do you make of that one, Stephen?
Absolutely, I think that's human nature, and if you overvalue something, then obviously that can be a problem in the workplace. And so I guess that's why you want independent consultants from time to time come in, check out what you're doing, and determine, well, is this really the best way to do it? And if they're able to determine, well, you know, because you know, it's not their baby. They can figure out, you know, no, this is not necessarily the best way. You know, over here is the best way, and you know, it shines a little light on it. That's why you have independent people come in from time to time and look things over. So, yeah, I can see that point of view.
And yeah, I think the idea of an independent set of eyes is a good one, and to just swing this one back to both the corruption idea and also the constant surveillance idea. One of the things we didn't talk about explicitly when we were talking about the corruption tracking, corruption monitoring idea, was that eventually it would probably be automated systems that would be doing all this. There's no way a person would be able to keep up with all that activity. You would need a computer system to do that. And this is, as I like to put it, this is another possible entry point for the robot overlords, right? This is where you might have an AI system that's just there to monitor the ethical nature of business behavior and keep everything in check. And as scary as that sounds, that's probably a better thing to have wake up and become a AGI than, say, some trading algorithm, right? Because those would be just totally cutthroat and all about destroying the other business. So if you had this ethical enforcement, well, you might end up with a very prudish set of robot overlords, but at least they would be the good guys, right? They would be working for the good. But prior to that, prior to the robot overlords taking over, this might be one of the kinds of things that we ultimately see tracked through some kind of artificial intelligence or some kind of expert system. You know, not just are we being corrupt, but are we actually proceeding logically? And it's possible that that external point of view you were talking about wouldn't have to be a consultant at all, right? It could be that we just plug the numbers in and the computer would spit back out, no, you're throwing good money after bad. This project will never work. Move on, right? Or better yet, here's a way you can turn this around and make it work. Now, that would be a great thing to get from an artificial intelligence. But that something could give that perspective to say, look, I'm sorry that I can't give you all the warmth I can right now, but the confidence thing is really missing in this project. I know you're really attached to it, but you have to let it go. You have to.
Well, there's another thing to think, keep in mind on this IKEA effect, is particularly from your point of view as a marketer. You know, don't necessarily when you're putting a product out there, don't make it too easy, I guess. You know, if your consumer works a little bit for it, they're going to love it even more. So they gave the example of instant cake mixes back in the 50s. You know, I mean, literally you added water, you put it in the oven, and boom, it was good. They found that they sold better once they started selling them where you had to add an egg. You know, so.
Right? Yeah, it's like they added labor, and then that additional labor, yeah, made it seem more worthwhile to the people who were using the cake mix. That is really bizarre, isn't it? But maybe that accounts for why Microsoft took off in such a huge way.
Yeah, the DOS was a lot more trouble. So
yeah, it was very labor intensive, you know, to work with them. By the time you got your system going, you were really invested in it. So naturally, you would.
Oh, gosh.
Actually, you know what, Stephen? I have another great example. This explains why we're so loyal to this program.
Well, yeah, in spite of all the glitches and, I mean, that we have week after week, we keep coming back. It's like, you know, I don't know.
It's because of all the work
sadism
we put into
or whatever. Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, well, masochism, I think. But when you consider, especially early on, all the labor we put into this, back when we had to do it through this much more labor-intensive process than we use now, I think that might actually account for why we're so caught up in this show. We paid the price. So, and now that we've diagnosed, maybe we can move on with our lives. I don't know, but not before we deal with the other two items on the list. Hey, actually, before we do that, I thought we might check in with Michael and see if there were any interesting observations on our first 8 breakthroughs from anyone in the chat room.
Holy cow, way too many.
Yeah.
Let me say this. At least Sally pointed out that the list having come from Harvard Business sort of explains why the list is focused in a particular way. And then there's this this guy who keeps pointing out that, yeah, this stuff is old news. This is not new. Oh, yeah, that was me. But beyond that, there's way too much coming up in the chat to summarize briefly.
Fair enough. Well, glad we got a lively chat going on. I think that's a good point you raised, though, Michael, that I think these are interesting ideas depending on what you do with them, where you take them. But actually, having read over the list, and I've only looked closely at the first 10. I haven't looked closely at the second 10. But I'm not blown away by it. I've spent too much time with Singularity Institute and people like that. But I look at this list, and it's not hitting me with a huge wow factor. What do you think, Stephen?
Yeah, you know, they're going to be focused on things that are big business ideas in the Harvard Business Review. So, I mean, you know, this thing like the IKEA effect, you know, I mean, or IKEA factor, that might be this, you know, this fad that goes through, you know, we'll probably see 5 books written on it in the next year or so, you know. And then it'll kind of fade away like so many other fads in business thought. But it's, you know. But I think there's some value to it. I mean, you know, if you understand the IKEA factor, maybe you can avoid it within your internal business, and maybe exploit it when you're trying to sell things. So,
I think there's definitely some value in the ideas, but they're a little closer to home than some of the future facing material that we normally deal with. And maybe that's a good thing. It's kind of fun to.
No reveal here for next week if we're going to do the other 10. I actually think there's 2 things in the second part of the list that are kind of eye-popping and in a cosmic, hey, the singularity's around the corner kind of way. But I don't want to give them away.
Okay, yeah, let's not give them away. And I won't do my Battlestar Galactica spoilers tonight either, so we'll save everything for the future. Let me just say that this Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're working our way through a list of breakthrough business ideas from the Harvard Business Journal, and we're up to number 8, consumer safety for consumer credit. Tell us about that one, Stephen.
Okay, another kind of dry one, but we'll hit it real quick. The idea is that we're protected as consumers by just about every product is in the market now. We're protected from the old buyer beware, you know, thought. If the product is dangerous, or if the product is not useful as advertised, then there's recourse as buyers, except in every way except for maybe things like credit cards and lending in general. And the idea is here, you know, we as borrowers are not on the same playing field as these trillion-dollar banks and lending institutions, and therefore, you know, we ought to be protected. And I agree. That seems illogical, and I think and only fair. So, yeah, we'll probably be going in that direction in the coming future. So, not much to say though.
Yeah, I think that's a safe bet that we would move in that direction. Here's 2 observations about this real quick that got my attention. One is, I think we have to do something about problems with consumer credit, because we're all living in the future where money is concerned, and this brings us back to our whole speculonomics and the economic singularity discussion. The fact that we get away with as a country, or that businesses get away with, or that we get away with as individuals living on credit, that should destroy us all. But the reason it doesn't destroy us all necessarily is that productivity keeps increasing, and we do end up with more wealth in the future than we had in the past. There has been a net gain of wealth over time, such that the government can become increasingly less efficient and can spend more money, and yet we still keep on rolling. And back in the 80s, everyone predicted that by now everything would be bankrupt, and we'd, you know, the federal government would be out of business. And now we're just now reaching the point where everybody's saying that about how much money is being spent. But it seems to me that that somebody actually has to live more or less responsibly, right? You can't have a profligate government and a profligate business sector and a profligate citizenry all at the same time.
Right.
Somebody has to live inside their means. And I think if we could get consumers protected from debt abuse, that's probably a good start. But getting them off the debt machine altogether would probably be better. If people cannot borrow so much money, then maybe even if the government borrows all that money, it's not going to represent our absolute.
Well, the bad thing about that, Phil, is if the government borrows so much money that people are pushed out of the market, which could, you know, the borrowing market, which, you know, that's a foreseeable future, if you ask me, then that's not a good thing. I mean, if somebody 10 years out of college and working hard still can't get a loan to buy a house, I don't think that's necessarily a good thing. So, you know, anyway, that's...
I can see that, and I have another possible concern with this, and this actually goes to what do we lose when we get protected from something? You know, there's no question. I don't think anybody would disagree that we all like having safe products. That it's a good thing that, you know, we can rely on our cars not to blow up, and, you know, that the wiring in our houses isn't going to catch on fire, and all the kinds of things covered under consumer product safety, we agree with all of them. But I'm going through this experience. My wife and I are going to have a baby here in about a month and a half, and buying all these, or getting as gifts, all these baby apparel, all this baby equipment, right? This stuff has warnings on it like you wouldn't believe, okay? I mean, you know, the car seat and the crib and the boppy and the – I mean, they've got – you know, there's a warning here, and then there's one up there, and then there's one down there. And we were actually hooking the – it's like the little Flexa stroller where you take the infant car seat and you snap it right under the stroller, and it's a stroller, okay?
Yeah.
I was looking through the instructions for putting that thing together, and it starts off with some warnings. Warning, don't do the – you know, don't – you know, submerse the baby underwater. You know, I mean, all these, like, you know, things, you know, things. Exactly. You know, don't use the car seat as a doorstop, you know, I mean, and it's like danger, you know, warning, caution, note, 11 pages of that. Okay. 11 pages of that. And you think, well, what does all of that do? What does all of this consumer product protection do? Does it make me more risk averse than I was before, or does it finally just make me immune to the protection? Right? Do I get? Because I mean, 11 pages is just overwhelming. I'm like,
yeah, you're not going to read that.
It
gives the company maybe some protection from liability. We warn them, you know, not to do this crazy thing.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, beyond that, it has no. You know, who's going to sit there and read 11 pages of warnings? Nobody.
Exactly. What it does ultimately is it makes me immune to listening to warnings. It's like the boy who cried wolf. You know, if there's a few serious things I should really seriously be paying attention to and being cautious about, just tell me those. And I think that might be the possible downside to consumer safety for consumer credit would be if we swing way overboard with it, and then there's no opportunity for people to take risk. There's no opportunity for anyone ever to lose any money. You've got a pretty tight, pretty constrained system, and that probably on the upside limits how good things can get too. That would be the big danger there.
Yeah.
All right, moving on to number 9, state capitalism makes a comeback. This is an interesting trend. These guys were Ian Bremmer and Juan Pujadas, talking about the return of the idea of governments managing large entities and large flows of capital. And they talk about how China and Russia are kind of leading the way in these governments who are taking back control of big pieces of the private sector.
Right.
Now, one of the things to be very concerned about here is that state ownership of business can put the state in a compromised foreign policy position. And the example that the authors give is if you're a legitimate state-run business, but you're in partnership with, you know, some authoritarian government, and now suddenly you've got a dependency on that government, you've got a dependency on that state interacting with your business, that becomes a license for bad behavior for that state. And, you know, that's assuming good intentions on the part of the original actor, right? I mean, when you look at maybe not so much China, but Russia, you can't even assume that necessarily, right? You look at it and you go, well, even all things being equal, I'm not sure that the intentions are going to be all pristine when Russia takes control of a few sections of its private sector. But anyway, the ones they talk about are asset management, shipping, telecommunications, and energy. These are the sectors that are particularly at risk, that particularly seem to be falling back under the control of large state players.
Right.
And what do you make of that one, Stephen? I find that one kind of disturbing.
Well, it is disturbing, but I think it's important for it to have been included in this Harvard Business Review collection of important business trends or ideas, because I think it is happening. And in business or whatever you're in, you need to be aware that the states are getting back involved in controlling things. And so, is it a good or bad thing? I think it's a bad thing by and large, because when you remove control from the local, when the control is local to the problem, and people that have a vested interest, they are rewarded when there's success, and they are basically punished by failure. When those people are the ones that are calling the shots, I think you get a better decision-making process than you have when it's some remote bureaucrat that's deciding, how a newly nationalized bank should lend money. I just think that you end up with a big mess with statism, but, I do believe that that's what's happening in many countries throughout the world. So it's important that they include it.
I think so. Well, one of the things that I would look at as possibly mitigating this is that if you look at those four sectors, asset management, shipping, telecommunications, and energy, asset management, there's not a lot you can do there to break that one up. But look at shipping, for example. We talk about this push towards ultimately replication technology, towards everyone being able to do their own manufacturing, right? There's a great possibility for even just kind of a increased local emphasis on having goods produced can take a lot of the strength out of that one, right? It's like, yeah, that's a very powerful sector, and it's dangerous that governments are controlling that, unless shipping becomes a lot less important, and then it wouldn't matter as much. Telecommunications, I think, is a sector that's already lost a lot of its clout. There are still big, formidable telecom companies, but they're nothing like they once were. And the real value seems to belong now to those who ride content on top of that network, rather than the people who own the network. And even with energy, when we talk about the solar singularity, when we talk about individuals being able to capture their own energy, or things like those, I can't remember the name of the company, but those miniaturized nuclear power plants that nuclear batteries that might be used to power communities. I think there's a whole decentralization case to be made for the economy moving in directions that would make it, I think, less dangerous that the government was in those sectors, simply because those sectors become a lot less important.
Other sectors that are, the economy is growing and moving so fast that the government can't keep up, basically.
Right. Exactly. That's my optimistic take on that one.
Okay. All right. The last one for this evening. Now it's time to invest in Africa. This is an article by Paul Collier and Jean-Louis Warnholtz. It says there's an opportunity in sub-Saharan Africa. The economies are growing at a rate of 6.3%. The region seems to be stabilizing politically and developing trade-friendly policies. That's funny, just a couple of weeks ago, two or three weeks ago, we were asking each other, had we heard anything good about what's happening in developing Africa, and we admitted to each other.
We had no good news to report, and here
there
it is.
No good, and here it is. Here's good news. And I think that's outstanding. I hope Africa continues to develop. It's good for the entire world when formerly destitute areas of the world step into the world economy, and that's great. And so, am I necessarily sending my 401k to Africa? Maybe not, but I could see diversifying in somewhat into Africa. So that's great. So
I think we could send Michael's 401k to Africa. I think, you know. Actually, it's interesting. They say that studies are showing return on capital at 65 to 70% higher for those who are investing in companies in sub-Saharan Africa than similar businesses in India, China, and Southeast Asia. So, so Michael, that's just so you get the best return on your money. You understand that's why I'm throwing that idea out there. But actually, there's something. You know, even beyond what you said, because it is great. It's great for Africa, and I hope it continues, and I'd really like to see good things happen there. But it is good for the world that when, you know, the economy seems to be collapsing everywhere else, you can look there and say, hey, here's actual growth occurring. Here's a you know, this could even be the place where we might find a way to turn it around. So it's very encouraging to see that happening, and I agree with you. I hope to see good things happening in Africa.
Absolutely. Well, does that finish our show up?
Well, that takes us through the first 10. We'll do 10 more next week. What do we got for music this evening?
And I want to point out that the next 10 next week, there is going to be more speculistic type things involved in the next 10. So make sure to tune in next week. The artist this week is named Sherry, and the song is Sunday.
Okay, the song is Sunday. The artist is Sherry. Next week it gets more speculist, so Sally and others, you know, don't forget to tune in next week. We'll look forward to having you on the program. All right, we'll listen to that music, Stephen. Thanks for your contributions this evening, and to you, Michael, and to everyone in the chat room, we'll look forward to being with you all again next week on the next Fast Forward Radio. Until then, live to see it.
No, I won't be leaving with you. Walk the soul right off my shoes. You should enjoy yourself sometimes. Call me crazy and I don't know. Got a new car and a brand new life. I got a new